You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1982 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the first class in a series given by Brother Paul Zillmer on the subject, Problems of Suffering Job.
Most people in most times, and certainly it's true of our age, most people don't read poetry. Fewer now read it even than did once upon a time. I guess we all read a little bit of poetry now and then, the limerick in the newspaper or the greeting card sentiment, which is generally written in poetry. But that's about it. We go for the fluff. We don't go for the serious stuff. And the same is true in other areas, of course. Best-selling novels are adventures or romances or fantasies. The books that are considered serious fiction by the people of this world, books that dig into people's minds and try to explain how men and women deal with the world as it really is, how they confront their own feelings. These books are printed in issues of thousands, not millions. And they're all mainly read by the same small group of people, the academics, and the minority that are interested in things that are beyond the superficial. But I think that poetry is probably read by the least number of people. Plays and novels, we know, have a narrative base to keep our interest. Even nonfiction writings, such as essays, are a straightforward presentation of ideas, and they will capture an audience to a greater extent than poetry does. But serious poetry is just plain difficult. There's no two ways about it. Even though the language that's employed may be beautiful and may be attractive to us on that level, there's no getting around the fact that the poet is attempting to convey thoughts, ideas that are complex, that deal with the very fundamentals of life and death and the way men and women really are. And whenever you read poetry, you can just about bet that there's going to be symbolism and metaphors and a whole host of literary devices that you will first have to discern and then unravel to find out what the poet is really trying to get at, what he's trying to convey to his reader. And in this generation that's hooked on television, I suppose it's no wonder that poetry is often ignored. When we come to the Bible, well, the Bible isn't read to start with. And the poetry that's in the Bible is almost unknown. The biggest single book of the poetry, the Psalms, is an exception. The Psalms are songs. Songs have always been universally popular. The Psalms, like most songs, tend for the most part to express thoughts and themes that can be appreciated by anyone. Praise and distress and thanksgiving and pleas for help. And they're short. We have to concede that the flesh is more apt to attempt something that's short than something that's long. I'm not saying that the Psalms are superficial. They certainly are not. There's much depth there. But they do use language that even on the surface, even if you don't dig into them, convey emotions and truths in a very powerful way, and so they enjoy great popularity. But beyond the Psalms, the Old Testament poetry that's in the Bible gets much the same treatment as general poetry does in the world. There are exciting narratives in both Old and New Testaments. There are in-depth nonfiction essays, the letters, to occupy our attention. We in this room here claim to be Bible students. But how many of us have ever actually sat down and read the Song of Solomon straight through? It's only 6 pages long. But just at one sitting, to sit down and read the whole thing straight through. How about Zephaniah? How about Lamentations? Those of you who read from the King James Version, where the poetry is not separated from the prose in the way that it's laid out, so you can't tell, may not realize even that most of Isaiah and much of Jeremiah and all of Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah are poetry. Gee, maybe that's why we don't know so much about what's in those books. Even when we read the Proverbs, which is also, of course, poetry, I'll bet most of us don't glean more than 3 or maybe 4 thoughts out of each chapter when we read a chapter. Even though, as we're well aware, after chapter 9, every single chapter is just crammed with wisdom. But how much of it do we get out when we read it? Jesus took several of his parables from the Proverbs. He would take 1 or 2 verses from the Proverbs, expand it into a whole story, and it became the basis of a big element of his teaching. What if every verse of the Proverbs could be treated in that way, in the way that Jesus handled it? How much have we been missing? Well, as I mentioned last night, the book of Job is written in poetry. With the exception of the first 2 chapters, 5 verses in chapter 32 and 11 verses in chapter 42, all of the rest of it is poetry. Now, it's hard enough to get somebody to read a 2-page poem, but it's a little like pulling teeth to get somebody to sit down and read one that's 40 pages long, which is what Job is in my Bible. So here's a little group participation exercise. How many here have ever read Job straight through at one sitting? Takes about an hour to do that. How about within a period of, say, 2 or 3 days? If you've read the whole book of Job within a period of a couple of days. A few. Now, how many have skipped chunks of it when it comes up in the daily reading? I could ask the ultimately embarrassing question, I suppose, how many have never read the book of Job, but I won't go quite that far. My point is that few people are genuinely familiar with the book, even though almost everyone has opinions about it. Since few of us could outline the book from memory, I have handed out this summary that I prepared of the content of the book of Job. If we had the time, a dramatic reading would be much better to familiarize ourselves with the contents. But this is going to have to do, I'm afraid. You'll notice on the far left are the chapter numbers, and next to that is the name of the speaker, and there's a number next to the name. Job 1 means Job's first speech, and so on. As in any summary or any outline, the preparer's prejudices can creep in. And I would ask you to please let me know if you think I've slanted things or altered the emphasis of the speeches involved, because I don't want to be in the position of misleading, and I'm certainly open to discussion. If you can manage it this week, if you can manage it this afternoon, would be best. It would be most advantageous if you could set aside an hour and read Job. I don't know what Brother Fred has in mind to do with his readings class, but maybe this afternoon could be a reading of the book together. We aren't going to be able to have time to treat this subject as though it's totally unfamiliar to you. I'm going to have to assume that there is some basic familiarity, or we won't be able to get anywhere. Back to our discussion of poetry. I think it's most reasonable to ask why in the wide world Job should have been written as poetry rather than prose. The writer could have just spelled out in probably a few pages the ideas that he meant to get across. Or if the writer or God who inspired him chose to convey the ideas in a story, as much of our Bible is, this could have been straight narrative. In the same way that we read about David or Moses or other people in narrative about their lives. There's some powerful drama in this story that's hard to see unless you do read the whole thing all at once. It would, I think, make a very fascinating play. So why is it poetry? Why should we make it harder? And another thing that we have to consider is that by putting dialogue into poetry, which is what almost the entire book is dialogue, the writer has had to take some liberties with what was actually said. I don't believe it's possible that these men sat around composing poems to one another. And so it was a later writer who put it into poetry. Now, I think in this inspired account, we can be certain of the accuracy of the ideas, but the exact words that the people spoke have been lost. So poetry is difficult to write, it's difficult to understand, And it sacrifices absolute accuracy of detail. So why go to all that trouble? Why, in fact, does anyone go to the trouble to write poetry? Well, I'm not sure why it is, because I'm not an expert, but it is true that poetry conveys emotions far more powerfully than prose does. That's an important reason it's used in the Bible. God's word is designed to have an impact, which is another way of saying that it is to affect us emotionally as well as intellectually. You'll seldom hear poetry quoted by people who would make the Bible into merely an academic exercise. Poetry is also easier to memorize than prose, and this is another important reason it's used, something that we probably make too little use of. Perhaps getting closer to the main point, poetry is economical. This is part of what makes it difficult. A lot of meaning is packed into a few words, and very often there are intended meanings on entirely different levels simultaneously. And so we can go through a mere secular poem, for instance, and analyze it on several levels of meaning. And all of those levels is not just invented by a critic. Those levels of meaning were intended by the poet. And the same is true with Bible poetry, of course. By putting meaning into fewer words, the impact is increased. And I would like us just to look at a couple of examples from Job itself. If you'll turn with me to the 6th chapter, just the first 3 verses. Then Job answered, "Oh, that my vexation were weighed, and all my calamity laid in the balances. For then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words have been rash." Job could have described how his great suffering and feeling of frustration affected his judgment to where he perhaps said rash things, and maybe when he was actually speaking this, that's exactly what he did. But how empty just a mere description is like that. Here we have not only an economical expression of what might be called the psychological reasons for why Job said the things he did, but simultaneously with this psychological explanation is an expression of the very anguish that's the motivation. "Oh, that my vexation were weighed! It would outweigh the sea!" That's what he's saying. It's not just words that are said. There is emotion in these words. And all this is conveyed in fewer words than I've taken to talk about it. If you go to chapter 28 and start at verse 12, "But where shall wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know the way to it, and it cannot be found in the land of the living. The deep says, 'It is not in me,' and the sea says, 'It is not with me.' It cannot be gotten for gold, and silver cannot be weighed as its price, and it cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold and glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewels or fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot compare with it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. Whence then comes wisdom? And where is the place of understanding? It is hid from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon and death say, 'We have heard a rumor of it with our ears.' God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the wind its weight and meted out the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then he saw it and declared it. He established it and searched it out. And he said to man, 'Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding.'" This exalted description of wisdom, I don't think could be matched in descriptive prose. No one talks like this. If somebody was in conversation with you, they would never talk like this. But this is meant to be read and savored and thought about and looked at again. You just can't read over something like this the way you would if it was just narrative. It was just said, somebody said, "Boy, wisdom is awful hard to get." You know, you'd just read all over that. You wouldn't even phase you. But this you can't read over. You have to stop and think about it because of the form that it's put into. Well, we have to recognize also that part of the economy of poetry comes in the painstaking choice of words that poetry demands. Dialogue, of course, is just whatever comes into the head of a speaker and he decides to say. But in Job, we have to realize that these words have been carefully chosen because it has been transformed from the original words of the speakers through an artist. Knowing this, then, that this artist has been able to, by thinking long and hard about it, convey just the right shade of meaning that he wants to put across, the ideas expressed in these words then carry greater weight. Because they aren't something spoken on the spur of the moment without thought. They're something that's carefully considered. And if it weren't for the form that it's in, we wouldn't know that. We wouldn't know that these words were carefully considered. So it makes sense to me that Job should be written in poetry. Great themes are dealt with, themes worthy of the highest form of expression. The subjects dealt with are very emotional ones. Why should the righteous suffer? And there's an added reason, the same one I think that caused Jesus to teach in his parables. A person must be willing to work at understanding it. Jesus told his disciples why he taught in that way, and we won't take the time this morning to turn up Matthew 13, but when the disciples asked Jesus why he taught them in parables, he told them that it was so that there would be a distinction made, so that those who had eyes and ears would be able to see, and those that didn't, it would become apparent that they didn't. We're talking about spiritual eyes and ears, of course. If a person is really seeking, the message will unfold itself in a beautiful way, just like it does in the parables. The artistry, then, that is involved in the presentation serves to enhance the message rather than detract from it. But if we're not willing to work at it, at understanding poetry, then the form itself serves to hide the message from us. And so, by the very means of revelation, God is able to separate his people from the rest of the world. Well, we can't spend too much time on the form of the book of Job, but before we leave the subject, I'd like us to just briefly touch on how Hebrew poetry is structured. Those who want to look into it more deeply, and I will confess myself not to be an expert on this subject, I've only barely scratched the surface myself. But those who want to look into it more deeply are invited to do so on their own. You're aware that English poetry is based on meter and rhyme. The meter is the pattern, the rhythm of the accented and unaccented syllables. I don't know if you can, you can see the accents there. This is a verse out of one of our hymns, which of course is also written in poetry. The slashes indicate the divisions of the rhythmical feet, as they're called, and the accented syllable is the second syllable of each foot in the case of this verse. The rhyme is the correspondence of sounds. The rhyme royal is just one of the forms. The letters A, B, and C represent a terminal sound. So lines 1 and 3 end with the same sound. Lines 2, 4, and 5 end with the same sound. And then the last two lines end with a third sound. Poetry like this is nearly impossible to translate. It's just, you just can't hardly do it. Because to get the meter and the rhyme transferred into another language, and also still have the same original meaning, if somebody's able to do that, it's essentially a new work of art. It's not merely a translation. But Hebrew poetry doesn't work quite the same way. Hebrew poetry does have a meter, but it's not quite as structured. The unaccented syllables are not counted, and only the accented syllables are the same. So the length of lines within a particular verse will be approximately the same, but not exactly the same. And rather than a correspondence of sounds, there is a correspondence of ideas in Hebrew poetry. There's no rhyme as such as we have in English poetry. What they do is play with ideas. Play in the sense of working with them, not with in a frivolous sense. This makes translation infinitely easier because you can, if you're willing to sacrifice the meter, which is tough to get into a new language. But if you're willing to just give up that, you can get the essential elements of the poetry into any language, and maintaining still the highest element of the poet's artistry, which is his balancing of ideas. And that those can be carried over into any language. So this makes Hebrew poetry much easier to deal with. Most Hebrew poetry is arranged into doublets and triplets, and a verse then is one doublet or one triplet. And these verses are further arranged into larger groupings, and then the larger groupings are themselves arranged in a pattern. And so you can see that the whole is a tightly structured form. It is not just loose the way it is, especially when you read in the King James Version. It's just one verse right after another without being able to see any of the structure that's behind it. When the poet then desires to express a radical change of thought or a change of emotion, he suddenly changes the structure. And right there, if you could read in the Hebrew, right there you would immediately be signaled that there's a change going on. Well, I think a lot of substance could probably be appreciated more by studying the structure, but that'll have to wait for us to do on our own, and it probably requires more knowledge of Hebrew, certainly, than I have. We'll just try to briefly look at a few doublets and triplets to illustrate the fundamental structure. And if we'll go to Job chapter 5, the first few verses will serve to illustrate most of the different kinds of doublets and triplets that we'll find in the book of Job. Verse 1 is a doublet. That is two lines in the verse. Call now, is there anyone who will answer you? Line 1. To which of the holy ones will you turn? That's line 2. You can see that the two lines say essentially the same thing. They are synonymous. And one of the forms of doublet is a synonymous doublet. Verse 2 is the same way. Surely vexation kills the fool, and jealousy slays the simple. Two ways of saying the same thing. So we have a synonymous doublet here. Triplets can also be synonymous, saying the same thing three times. Verse 3 is a doublet, but it's of a different sort. I have seen the fool taking root, but suddenly I cursed his dwelling. Now there's two opposite thoughts. The fool takes roots, but then he's suddenly cursed. So that's an antithetical doublet. Two opposing thoughts expressed. And the next verse shows us the third type, a synthetic. And this happens to be a triplet. His sons are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate. There is no one to deliver them. That's not quite synonymous. It's a progression of ideas, a synthesis or a building of ideas through the three lines of that verse. And then, if you wanted to go on, verse 5 is the same. It is another synthetic triplet. Verse 6 is another synonymous doublet. Verse 7 is another synonymous doublet. And then we come to the end of the one little grouping. I'm not going to mention this anymore this week, but it will be something just for you to look at on your own. I thought it would be worth going into it here a little bit because it will help not only with Job, but with the other poetical books when we read them. And I should just mention in that line that sometimes there are a couple of other forms. There's parallelism sometimes where you have thought A and then thought B in one doublet, and then thought A and thought B in the next doublet also. Or sometimes you'll have a mirror image, thought A and then thought B and then thought B and then thought A. Those are two other types that we don't generally find in Job but are in some of the other Hebrew poetry. We have to move on because the structure does not tell us, it helps us to understand and helps us to read, but it doesn't tell us really what Job is about. The basic story of Job, I think we're probably all familiar with, is about a man who loses everything, finally including his health to a terminal illness. So, is Job about suffering? Well, I think a little more is involved. There's something larger going on here. I think the ultimate big question is this main part of the substance of the book of Job, the issue of the relationship between God and man. How many philosophies have been promoted? We heard some from Brother Bill in direct reference to some of these things. The many philosophies that have been promoted to try to understand the relationship between God and man. How much bewilderment has there been over this subject throughout the ages? How many people even today wonder about the issues that are dealt with in this book? The answers, I think, are to be found here. The questions are complex. They're not easy questions, and they're very emotional questions. And Job is going to be our everyman who asks the Lord these questions on our behalf. Well, besides this, Job is about Christ, as the whole Bible is. We're going to consider later in the week the type of Christ that Job provides for us. Job is also, I think, about the ecclesia. How brethren get along and work together, or rather, in this case, how they fail to when a time of stress comes. But what happens also when we hang on to our own pet theories even when they don't fit the facts? And yes, ultimately, Job is about suffering. Suffering is a common denominator of all human existence. No matter what differences there are of wealth or when or where we live or age or any other distinction between one person and another, everyone suffers. Some more than others. Some much more than others. Why this should be, and how it fits in with our conception of God, is a major theme of this book. And we will spend much of Friday discussing this aspect of it. I believe there's another aspect also to what Job is about. And this relates to its place in God's plan, where the writing of this book falls. For this, of course, we're going to have to try to locate where and when the events of Job took place. It doesn't take us very long to discover that there aren't too many clues. I think there are enough clues, though, to at least tentatively establish a time and a place. And Brother David questioned me over my statements of last night, which were probably ill thought out. I probably stated a little too strongly my feelings last night about where this the events of this fall in time. Or not where the events fall, but where the writing falls in time. Our real clues mainly lie in the tribal associations that are given to Job and his friends and Elihu. And for those who wonder why God caused all of those boring genealogies to be preserved for us, it's for times like this, because we're going to need them now. Job, we are told, was from the land of Uz in chapter 1. Well, there are three men named Uz in the Old Testament. One is the grandson of Shem, mentioned in Genesis 10:23. There's a son of Nahor, Abram's brother, mentioned in Genesis 22:21. And there's a grandson of Seir the Horite, mentioned in Genesis 36:28. I'll read off these references for the sake of the tape. Now, because the descendants of Seir in this passage in Genesis are listed right in the middle of the family of Esau, and because the land of Edom continued to be known as Mount Seir for a long time afterwards, I think it's a reasonable deduction that the Horite people, and especially these descendants of Seir, became assimilated into Edom. They weren't driven out or destroyed, they were assimilated. And so very likely this grandson of Seir is the Uz that is of interest to us. It could have been Nahor's son, I suppose, but there is a region of Uz mentioned in Jeremiah 25:20. And in Lamentations 4:21, Jeremiah then equates Uz with Edom, uses the term synonymously. So Uz was very likely the name of a district in Edom, and Job was probably therefore an Edomite. Eliphaz is called a Temanite. Teman was the grandson of Esau, and therefore he was a great-great-grandson of Abraham. And that's in Genesis 36:11 and 1 Chronicles 1:36. Now, there were both a city and a region in Edom that were named after Teman, and that is probably one of the best documented things in the Bible. Just a couple of references, Genesis 36:34 and Jeremiah 49:7-20, but also there are references in Ezekiel, Amos, Obadiah, and Habakkuk. So Teman, which is often used as a synonym for Edom, was definitely an Edom, in Edom, and Eliphaz, therefore, was an Edomite, though probably from a different district than Job. Bildad, we read, was a Shuhite.
Now Shua was the son of Abraham, one of the sons of Abraham, by Keturah. We read in Genesis 25:2. He was settled by Abraham. It says, Abraham, we're told, settled all of these sons eastward in the east country. He's not mentioned anywhere else. This Shua is not. So presumably, very quickly, his descendants became assimilated into some other nation. If we can take the reference to the east country to be where Abram came from, where Nahor lived, and so on, which I think is most reasonable, Bildad, therefore, very likely lived in Mesopotamia. Zophar is called a Naamathite. Now, the derivation of Naamathite is not quite as clear. It may come from Naama, it may come from Naaman. Naama was an Ammonite female name. The Ammonites, of course, were the descendants of Lot, who was Abraham's nephew. There was a town in Canaan that was named Naama that was later in the allotment that was given to Judah in Joshua 15:41. That would have been an Ammonite town. The other possibility, then, is Naaman, which was the name of both a son and a grandson of Benjamin. No town or tribe was ever named after either of these Naamans that we know of. And they would probably, both of these men, probably lived their lives in Egypt anyway. So the Ammonite derivation seems much more likely to me, and so therefore Zophar would be an Ammonite. Elihu is the one we have the most biographical data on. He's called Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzzite of the family of Ram. Buzz would be his tribe, Ram, the family clan name. There was one Ram that we know of, Judah's great-grandson, but he could in no way be called a Buzzite, so that Ram is a different Ram. Buzz was a son of Nahor, Abraham's brother, in Genesis 22:21, and therefore was Lot's first cousin. He did not go west with Abraham and Lot. So presumably, he and his offspring stayed in the east. There is a region called Buz listed in Jeremiah 25:23 among a whole group of other eastern and Middle Eastern nations. Since Nahor lived in Mesopotamia, Genesis 24:10, Elihu also may have come from there. Perhaps he came with Bildad. Some of these friends seem to have traveled some to see Job. These distances that we're talking about are not small, with the exception of perhaps Eliphaz. And so that's some intimation of the importance that Job had. In chapter 1 and verse 3, he is said to have been the greatest of all the peoples of the East. So Job was a very important man. Job is possibly the oldest book in the Bible. If not, it is possibly comes after the Pentateuch in order of time of writing. It could conceivably have been written by Moses. Remember, he lived in the East himself for 40 years with his father-in-law, who was a Midianite. He could have learned about Job's experiences at that time and later committed them to writing. Or it could be that the Lord himself, in one of those conversations that he held with Moses as a man speaks to his friend, he may have revealed to him at that time. We don't know. That's totally speculation. If it was not Moses, I don't think the date could have been too much later than him. Evidence is provided for this very indirectly, but in the names of God that are used in the book of Job and the way that they're used. We know from Exodus 6 that God did not reveal to the patriarchs his memorial name, Yahweh. The patriarchs did not know him by that name. He was known to them as El Shaddai, which is a combination of two names, which is usually mistranslated as God Almighty in our English versions. Well, there are no less than 6 names of God used in the book of Job. And the way they're used, I think, gives us a clue to the time that it was written. The name Yahweh is used, and so that it's certain that the writer was a Jew. But it's used by the narrator. It's used in the same way that Moses used that name in Genesis. He inserted that name into the Genesis narrative before that name had been revealed, but he used it when it was appropriate, and the narrator of Job does much the same. Only once is the name Yahweh spoken by one of the characters, and that is by Job, but it's in the prose section. And Often in Genesis also we find in the prose descriptions people using the name Yahweh when as yet it had not been revealed. So we know that it was Moses putting that name in there because it was appropriate. There's one exception that you may notice if you read this today in chapter 12, which according to the oldest manuscripts should read Eloah instead of Yahweh, the Lord. But in the actual dialogue, the participants, and that includes God himself, use the patriarchal names, the three names, El, Eloah, and Shaddai. In Jewish writings later, including the rest of the Bible, these names are hardly ever used. Yahweh and Elohim and Adonai almost completely replace the patriarchal names in the later writings. But Job uses, or the book of Job employs all six names. And the old names are generally used by the speakers and the new ones by the narrator. So this, I think, is a strong clue that the writer was a Jew who lived early enough to still be very familiar with those patriarchal names and in how to use them correctly. And in fact, most of the understanding we get about how to use these names comes from Job and from some usage in the Psalms and in Genesis. Well, from all of this, we get sort of a fuzzy idea, at least, of where and when the events took place. Probably the place was Edom. If not there, maybe a little further to the east. Probably the time of the action was within a few generations from Jacob, probably when Jacob's descendants were still living in Egypt. It was written down perhaps one, two generations later. Although there are, I should acknowledge that there are those who suggest much later writing, and that's something that we aren't going to be able to get into. It at least seems clear that the date of the events of the book come between the flood and the law, and that is what really gives it its place in God's plan. We're all aware that in the beginning, our first parents sinned, and that created a gulf between God and man. God would have been entirely just to have destroyed man outright at that time, done away with him. But he had a purpose, and that would have thwarted the purpose that he had in mind for man. And so he put into effect a plan that would provide for escape, and he promised a seed of the woman through whom this plan would find its fulfillment. Well, he could have provided that seed any time. Eve's firstborn could have been that promised seed. In fact, there's indication she thought he was. When Cain was born, he said, "I've gotten the man from the Lord." Well, he wasn't it. Was mankind really ready so soon to accept the doctrine or the teaching of salvation by grace and faith? Would it really have served God's purpose to have removed the curse as soon as it was imposed? Well, we can't second-guess God, but it's apparent from what happened that his answer to those questions was no. Mankind was to be given a period of time to see just what had been wrought by sin, by introducing sin into the world. So there's no Christ yet. So what is going to be the basis of God's dealings with men? How is he going to relate to them? Well, if it was up to us, what would we do? When we're teaching small children, we institute a simple system of rules. And when there are infractions of the rules, we impose a punishment. The ultimate punishment for mankind was death, of course, but the Lord did not wish to make man extinct, and so he put off that ultimate punishment. We're told that God cursed the ground for Adam's sake. Now, this was universal for Adam and all of his seed. But then when Cain sinned, there was an additional curse placed on the ground, just for him, so that it would yield even less to him than to Adam. And later, Lamech, I think, implies, and it's not a direct statement, but I think he implies that the same thing happened to him after he committed his murder. We only have hints, but there seems to have been, in effect, a system of retribution, where each major sin was punished on the spot. Whether or not there were other punishments besides cursing the ground, we don't know. Probably not. But at the time of the flood, God says, "I will no more curse the ground for man's sake." He was going to bring that system to an end. Why? Because it didn't work. In spite of exact punishment for sin coming, men still corrupted their way utterly on the earth, to the point that God had to wipe mankind away except for that small remnant. And perhaps in this curse on the ground we find the reason for it being a flood rather than a plague or something else that wiped out mankind. The very ground itself had been so cursed that it needed cleansing, renewal. And so it was washed for a year by the flood. Well, the next major system, as we know, was law. As the New Testament shows us, the law didn't work either as far as preventing people from sinning, even though it was a step up from retribution, because after all, the law did promise life to anyone who could keep it. But as the New Testament is at great pains to teach us, the law, what the law really did was to point out sin, to point out that no one by works could be righteous in God's sight. And so at last, the promised seed was given and grace came to lead to finally the kingdom of God. The human race was treated by God as a growing child. First, a simple set of rules and punishments. Next, a code of conduct, both do's and don'ts. Finally, for the mature race, a system of principles to be voluntarily applied. Now, real salvation, of course, has always depended on grace and faith. But there was this orderly education process for man, instituted by God, to prove that faith and grace are the only way that we could gain salvation. If it hadn't been for the law of Moses, we might think, well, gee, if God just told us what he wanted us to do, we could do it. But he gave us the law to say, I did that, and you couldn't do it. The preacher in Ecclesiastes says, because punishment is not swift, therefore men continually sin. But there was a time when punishment was swift, and they still sinned. Mankind's heart is so dark, as our brother exhorted us last night. The only way is grace, and the only access to grace is by faith, and God proved it to mankind. Well, Job fits in between the flood and the law. We don't know just what system of worship was in effect, but Abraham, for instance, both offered sacrifices and gave tithes, so there was some system of worship. God didn't just leave man to with nothing. But it's not surprising at such a time, I think, to find great misunderstanding, great confusion about God, about what he required of man. There's a great deal of misunderstanding even now, even with the whole of the plan of God revealed. And I don't think there could be anything more topical than a book that deals with ignorance about God, because there is a great deal of that now. And so we find that Job's friends who came to condole with him were convinced that the Lord was operating by a system of exact retribution. They embellished the notion by suggesting that all hardship, not merely a curse on the ground, was a retribution for sin. This was their theory. That same theory was still current in Jesus' time. The Pharisees taught it. And in their confusion, the disciples couldn't figure out when they came across the man born blind. They said, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus said, that theory is just hogwash. It's nothing. There's no retribution for sin involved in this man's blindness. And so the issues dealt with in Job apply in New Testament times. And the theory is not unknown today either. I used to work with a woman who would absolutely break down in tears, wondering what it was that she'd done wrong anytime the slightest bad thing happened in her life. She was convinced that every trouble was a punishment from God. Well, if these people are wrong, why do people suffer if it's not as an exact punishment for sin? Especially, why do believers suffer? Why did the Christ have to suffer? What does God expect of us? And what can we expect of Him? And how does this affect the way we interact with each other? These are the universal and very important questions that the book of Job is all about. And we will begin tomorrow by taking a look at the cast of characters in order of their appearance to begin to find the answers.